Page Fright is recorded on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. These territories were stolen, and they are now the space where I inhabit and live. But the guests you're hearing on this podcast often come from different territories across what is now known as Canada. I encourage our guests, and I encourage you as well, listening at home, to take a moment to consider the territory you're on, its history, and how you might have come to belong here. Welcome to Page Fright. My name is Andrew French. I'm on Instagram at Andrew W. French. This, of course, is the world's first and only podcast that I host. I am thrilled about today's episode, as always. Another great guest, and it's one that we're familiar with from recent history here on the show. Matt Rader joining me again, this time for a full-length episode. He was on as part of the Best Canadian Poetry episode a couple months ago, maybe January or February. And speaking with Matt was really cool. I had to ask him again in this interview about a couple of things that came up in that first one because they've been on my mind since. I've really been thinking a lot about his answers to those questions, and that's continued in the week or so since we recorded this episode as well. I'm really thrilled with how this interview turned out, and I'm excited to share it with you. But before we do, just wanted to say that at the end of the interview, Matt mentions a few readings that he's got coming up. And so I would suggest, you know, if you're interested in what Matt's doing, stick around to the end of the episode. I hope you always do, but especially this one, just to hear where those readings are and when. They are going to be awesome. I'm so excited. They're all over BC. And in addition to that, just in general, we're going into like book launch season, book tour season, and there's a ton of poetry events happening in Vancouver and beyond. And so just want to gesture towards those and say you should get to them if you can. It's poetry month. That's why we got two episodes this month. And the biggest part of poetry, I think, is the community aspect. That's why this show exists. That's why I keep coming back to doing it. And so I hope that you'll engage with the poetry community a little bit this month, even if you've been out of touch for a little while. Self-plug before we get into the episode, I will be reading at Massey Art Society May 12th, 3 o'clock p.m. As part of the Dead Poets reading series. I'll be reading Louis Dudek. I'm really excited to share some of his work, and maybe an original poem. We'll see. But I'm going to be there reading, and I'm super excited about it. If you are in Vancouver, there's a chance to sign up. You can do so through Eventbrite. I'll put the link below the episode. But yeah, that's another, if you're not engaging with your poetry community, there's a chance to do it, and I'll be there. So come say hi. Let's jump into the episode. Let's talk about Matt Rader. So Matt Rader is back, folks. He's a fantastic writer, and let me read you his bio. He is an award-winning author of 6 volumes of poetry, a collection of stories, and a book of nonfiction. His previous book of poems, Ghost Hawk, which came out in 2021, was shortlisted for the Dorothy Livesey Poetry Prize. He teaches creative writing at the University of British Columbia, Okanagan, and lives in Kelowna, BC. Here I am chatting with Matt Rader. Okay, it is Poetry Month, and I am here with our second guest of the month. Normally, this is a monthly podcast, semi-monthly anyway, but I'm doing 2 episodes in April, partially because it's Poetry Month, and partially because I forgot to do one for March. So we're here with a second poet for April, and it's Matt Rader. Matt is back. Matt, how are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. I'm really excited. It's a nice Friday. I don't know how the weather is up there, but in Vancouver, gorgeous. We got a beautiful day. Yeah, it's a nice day, and I'm excited to talk about your new book. We kind of teased it a little bit. We talked a little bit about it when you did an interview just 2 episodes ago. It's been a while, but just 2 episodes for the Best Canadian Poetry episode. But your book is Fine. It's called Fine. I'm not rating it. It's called Fine, and it's out with Nightwood, and I'm so excited to chat about it. We're going to dive in. But before we get to asking you questions, I'm wondering if you could share a reading with us just so that we could get acquainted with the book.
Yeah, this is the title poem. It's the first poem in the book. Where I lived, there were still grasslands, but very few, between the condos and roadways and subdivisions. The grasses, my friend said, were fire in its low entropy state, but fire was no kind of grass. I wanted to say something back then about the synonyms territory, state, condition. I wanted to make a shift from fire to fine, its averageness, its elegance, its penalty. Then the helicopters lifted the cold, dark energy of the lake into the sky like a chalice. There was an icon on my phone that looked like a face disguised by smoke. There were masks that helped us breathe by restricting our breathing. There were evenings of no smoke when we could see for ages across the valley through all time. Our medicine was medicine and walking among the drought-stricken yellow cedars, seeing the bodies of people moving through water, especially women, which even then stirred me, also men. Also, not everything had definition, like smoke, fantasies, a third thing I felt too shy to mention. I'd always wanted to be funnier than I was, but verily we laughed, looking for our phones, which we were clutching, looking at pictures of our hair. In those days, we grew tomatoes so sweet and deformed we called them care. We were aware of a shape we could not regard directly, lurking at the center of things. We will have been that shape is all we could say truthfully about what we knew. With our hands, we could swim in the museum through screens of digital modeling, unthickened time, to see the city before the city, its reeds and waterways, the white outline specter of buildings hovering above everything, the future interior, what we were, what we will have been.
I love this poem so much. I'm glad it's the first one, and I'm glad it's the first one that you read for us today. Sometimes I do this really mean thing where I ask poets the first question, tell me about your book, elevator pitch your book to me. I'm not going to do that because I have a question that kind of does that for you, I think. So there's a lot of really beautiful things in this book. But one recurring source of beauty is the way that you kind of juxtapose natural disasters and global warming and all of these things against moments of real, just everyday meaning. And so I'm wondering, when you are looking into or writing a poem about these heavier sorts of themes, where do you look for inspiration in those sources of meaning and beauty?
Do you mean where do I look for, like, how do I not get sucked into the horror or the despair? Is
Exactly.
that what you're
Yeah,
asking?
pretty much.
Well, I think the idea is that if you're going to look at the disaster that's unfolding, and look clearly at it. And this might be a thing that one might apply to oneself and one's own life. All of one's disasters and mistakes and transgressions and all of those things. It matters just as much, or it is like it is important to put those things in context with all of the other affective registers and moments of kindness and all of the thing the count like what Simone Weil might call like the grace and the gravity that those you that you have to look just as clearly at those things. And that's not to say that that's a Pollyanna-ish kind of like we can still be happy while we're burning. That's not what I mean. I mean that the real like pain of the burning is in relation to the real joy of seeing someone you love, or looking at I'm looking out my window right now at the blooms on the lilac tree, and like those things are what ratify the pain on one hand, And then the pain ratifies the beauty. And I don't mean that you need to have both of them together, or that you can't experience beauty without it. But if you're asking how do you look at one thing and find a source of inspiration, it's to just to make sure that you're to the best of one's ability, not only looking at the shadow. You know that if there's a shadow, it means that there's a source of light, and so it's just as legit to look, turn around and look at the source of light. If you want to put it in those terms.
Yeah, absolutely. That is a very good analogy to use to explain that. Yeah, a lot of the poems in here deal with things like climate crisis and natural disasters and all of these things that are heavier. And so it did really strike me the way that there are so many moments of beauty, and they come both from, the actual things that are being described, like the images themselves, in the book, but also the way that you're describing them. I wanted to come back quickly to that first poem because, my experience of reading your book was very fun for me. The first poem, I was so excited when I read it because it kind of was a glimpse of what was to come, and I was so pumped. One thing that I love and that I'm trying to do more in my writing is play with line breaks and make a poem a little bit more twisting, in that sense. And so from the very first two lines of your first poem, your lines are, "Where I lived, there were still grasslands," line break, but very few. So immediately, not a contradiction, but a challenge to the line that came before it. And I was like, okay, this is fantastic. So I was wondering a little bit about if you make a conscious effort to, keep your reader guessing with these line breaks. What is kind of your strategy as you're coming to the end of a line?
I think we talked about a version of this last time we spoke, I think. And so I like that you still this little bit of obsession for you is continuing, and I
Absolutely.
it's a good thing. Patrick Friesen told me once that you should just follow that obsession as long until you're no longer obsessed with it, and just keep going. In this book, I tried really hard. I wanted to make the lines clearer. Which is a funny way because I think you're right, they do twist, and there are significant enjambments that really propose additional readings. And as that poem, for example, moves down the page, you get kinds of interesting things that you can't really hear in the reading, but so for example, that second sentence that begins, "The grasses, my friend said, were fire," the end of that sentence is a line that actually reads, "Of grasses, I wanted to say something back then." But it's not the sentence it be the of grass, sorry, I wanted to say something back then. Maybe we should say that again. I don't know. That's a clarity. But the period is at the end of grass. So you get this enjambment where the poem this wanting to be sort of meta commentary on grass, but it then this of course the sentence goes on to talk about these synonyms of territory, state, and condition. So I'm like I am playing with this kind of twisting, turning, rhetorical, proposing one thing and then complicating it as you say said or taking it further, but each unit, I was trying to think of them as much as clearly as I could, so grammatically or metrically or even visually, and the poems are double spaced too, so on the page there's a lot of room around each line, and these were all efforts on my part to have that. The thing that poetry verse in particular does well, which is turn and loop and be non-linear, and yet have it be readable to people maybe even who don't read poems as often. I wanted it to be more readable than say my last book, and that was what I was paying attention to. Like, what's the first unit of thought? What unit of thought can I shift into the next line was and in the past I would have been more disposed to a kind of breaking those thoughts up And so I was trying in this book anyway, to not break up complete thoughts very often on a line.
Yeah, I think so. You're right. I do have an obsession with line breaks. I have an obsession with line length as well, and we talked about that last time too. Because one of the things that, if you haven't listened to that episode, that I particularly love about Matt's writing is that one line will just be way longer than the next sometimes, and it leaves me questioning it and being like, okay, why did Matt do this? What's going on here? And it makes me read the poem a lot closer, which I really love. And yeah, you talked a little bit there, and I talked too about the kind of like subversion that you get with enjambment sometimes, and the way that it can cause a poem to kind of snake its way around, which is always fun. I wanted to ask you a question that comes on the back of my last episode. I was talking to Kayla Zaga for the last episode, and I believe I brought up, it's been a blur, but that my writing over the past, now it's been 2 weeks or so, has really just started coming. And it's refreshing to me, and I think it's probably even more refreshing to listeners of this show who've heard me complain for so long about how I'm having a writer's block and whatnot. But over the past couple of weeks, things have really started flowing. And the reason they've started flowing for me is that I have stopped writing towards a project and just started writing. And in particular, one thing I've noticed over the past couple of days is that when I sit down to write, I'm sitting down with no expectation, not just for a project, but for the poem. And it comes a lot more clearly. I'm wondering, so a couple questions stem from this. The first one is, have you experienced this? Is this a strategy you employ of like, do you have a project in mind or not? And then second question is, when you have a project in mind, like you're putting together your manuscript for this book, does it become more challenging to add poems to that theme that you're already working with? Or what does that kind of look like for you?
I think those are all really good questions, and I have a suspicion that you already know the answers. And because on some level, I think I approach every poem when I'm writing it as if I don't know what it might be. And I don't know if I always did that, but I have, like, in last years, that has been more or less how it has come. When something became a project is somewhere down the line, when and it's usually as much a formal thing as anything. Like, okay, so now I've written 15 poems that are like 10 tercets long, and they've got 1 to 3 beats in a line, and I have a way that the tercets are supposed to work, and now I've got this little puzzle that I'm doing so that I can, like, see how many different kinds of things I can wring out of this one form, which is a good thing for my mind to do while I'm otherwise writing a poem, and in those cases, I'm not really thinking either about, like, what I'm trying to say. I'm just like, the monkey part of my mind wants to, like, deal with this problem of the tercets, and then I'm gonna work through it that way. When I was writing this book, I was just writing. Like, I had an instinct to make the lines double spaced. I don't really know why. I think I was really lit, like, in the most basic sense, just trying to give myself as much space as I could. And like, and I sort of hit on this. The thing about the lines in this book is, like, very few of them, if any, are the same length right after you, like, one following the other. So it's always a different kind of length. A line, one line falls another line of a different length. And somewhere in there, I hit on also, like, that I just really wanted to get as rid of as much punctuation as I could, and like all of these things to try and take it out, be a little bit different than I'd been before at the level of form, and also make it clearer to myself, like, less restrictive. But you're right that once you get to the place in which you have a kind of manuscript project that has, like, sort of asserted itself, like, we can imagine, oh, this could be a book, there is something here. Now you have, now you have to obey the rules of the project. Some level. And it does become a little harder. And I'm also the kind of writer who gets really like each book has a new problem formally for me, right? Like, so I don't really like I don't like staying in the same thing for too long. And yeah, so I didn't write anything for like quite a while after I wrote this book, for like almost a year.
Wow.
I started writing again in December, and I wrote a bunch of poems, and then I like maybe like four or five poems that I thought were, they could live on their own, as that's how I usually think about them. And I haven't written anything since then, but that's mostly because I've been busy. But I had to do this is the thing that I had to do. I'd be like, no, they're not double spaced anymore. They're only 1.5 spaced. Like, I don't know what I'm doing. I just give myself some completely meaningless, or at least initially meaningless, like constraint,
Yeah.
and it takes care of the need to feel like they're cohesive, and then I can just kind of like get into let myself write. But in terms of like what the poem is actually going to say, I never know. Like, I never really know what it's gonna what I'm aiming at. I'm following a kind of pattern as it emerges.
Yeah. Over the past two answers, you've got me thinking a lot about why, perhaps this weird phenomenon of finding the ability to write again has happened over the past couple of weeks. And first off, I want to acknowledge that the fact that double spacing your poems leaves space is both a fantastic pun and very true. There really is space between the lines, and I think that might be why I read so much into the line breaks and the endings, especially in your writing, is just because there is more space. You're creating more space there, and it leaves them as concise units of language. And yeah, so that's one thing. The other thing that I wanted to think about and talk about is that, yeah, like you said, sometimes when you write a poem, you don't know where it's going, and often that's the big advice you get from people who have written books is like, I don't know where my poems are going. I go where the poem wants me to go. And then me as a listener, both of that and then potentially to this show, are like, well, what the hell does that mean? Like, how do I logistically not know where the poem's gonna go? And for me, the past couple weeks, my meaning that I've found for that statement is I write a line with no expectation of what the next line's gonna be. And then when I get to the end of that line and I decide, okay, time for the next line, I try and do something that builds on the last one. And that's it. There's no destination, but a lot of purpose, if that makes sense. So that's where I'm at. Anyway, okay. We're at the everybody's favorite part of the show where I stop talking and ask a question from my last guest. So Matt, a question for you from Kayla Zaga. She's wondering, didn't know I was talking to you, but she's wondering, how do you order a collection? Is there anything you wish you tried in ordering the poems in your book?
This is my, I'm gonna say, I can't remember, sixth book of collection of poems. And I have tried all kinds of different things over the years. Originally, this manuscript was completely chronological. It was
Mm.
just like the first poem I wrote and to the last poem I wrote. And somewhere in the making of the book, in the layout of the book, Silas White at Knightwood, Silas really hates it when a poem, if he can get the poem on a single spread, or like the poem be, the first poem begin, like he's always trying to get it visually to line up, and that you don't have to turn, you're not like starting it on the recto and like turning it over to get the next, part of the poem. And obviously some poems are long, and that's just how it is, but where he can, he tries to avoid that. And I just said, you know what, Silas, whatever you want, put him put him any way that you think will work with this. Like, I was like, this is what I want. I just want to space a page between this thing and this thing and a page here. And I want this poem to be last, and otherwise, like, whatever works. So I just accepted what Silas said, because like the truth is, Silas has been doing it as long as I have. He knows as much as I knew about it, really. And I don't think that much.
Okay, yeah.
I don't think it's such a big deal how the poems are put together. There's some of it, obviously, he actually, you asked me about this poem before our conversation here, Real Things, and he wanted that poem to be the last poem for various reasons, and I didn't want it to be the last poem because of because it's a darkness to that poem, and it's just not where I wanted to leave things off tonally. So it's not like I don't think that there is or is any meaning to it. I just mean that you could rearrange it in all kinds of ways, and they would be of similar, value or pro
Yeah.
effect, or the different possibilities aren't. I don't know. I don't know about you, but even the books I love and read all the time, I'm dipping in and out of them. It's not like I read the book all the way through every single time. In
Yeah.
fact, whenever I try to do that, I find it very annoying to myself because I only get halfway through, and then I didn't read
Yeah.
those other po poems, and I'm like, I should have just gone to the ones I wanted,
Yeah.
so.
Yeah. Even preparing for interviews and stuff, like when I reread books, and I usually will go through a book like 3 to 5 times for an interview, but I read the whole thing once, you know, and then the rest of it is kind of like what I dog-eared, what I underlined, the greatest hits, and how do I come up with questions from there. And I imagine like most people have a way of marking or noting or remembering, even if you don't physically do it on the book, that you know, these are the poems that I really enjoyed from this book, and that's what I want to revisit. Because oftentimes, you know, I mean, there's half the time you'll think, okay, I really love book A, so I'm going to go and revisit the book. But I find more often I'm like, I really love that poem from that book, and then I got to go find that poem. Because it's like an album in a way, right? Our books, in that, like, it's really hard to get a no skip album. It's really hard to get a no skip book. I mean, they're out there, but they're hard to find. And yeah, I don't know. I do think a lot of people too, myself included, absolutely overthink the ordering of a book. Because often it does matter, it seems, mostly to the author. you know, I don't know.
I mean, I think obviously some books are more clearly they need to be in a certain order than other books,
Right.
depending on the way it's put together. This book does more or less follow a seasonal thing anyway. Like, it's not like Silas was like, oh, I'm going to completely rearrange everything. He just within the sections I had to rearrange things, and I have a sensitivity to it because of like a particular knowledge that I have around, say, when this flower is blooming compared to this other event in this in a different poem or whatever. But I don't know that it really matters that much. And I think, we celebrate the poetry's ability to be non-linear, and that yet I, so I think it just depends on the book a little bit. I think there are lots of different ways. I might try like a random way next time, like some kind of some kind of divination or something, pulling cards or throwing like the I Ching or something like that to see if and I'm only it's like half joking. Like it maybe I will like arrange them from like the least funny to the most funny. I don't know. That's something like that.
I love
These are
it.
things
I
that
love it.
I'm thinking about Kayla's question, like that I would like to try. And I'm not even joking. I would like it just to be funnier at the end somehow.
Funnier at the yeah. Okay, this does seem important to you because before we started recording, Matt asked me, which is my favorite question to get from a guest, is there a poem you'd like me to read? And I mentioned the one that we're gonna get to in a moment here. But Matt specifically said, okay, I can't read that one at the end because it's a little heavy. So it seems important to you to end on some levity.
Yeah, I mean, I was just at a faculty retreat all day yesterday, and
Okay.
at the end of the retreat, they had like one of those big rolls of paper, and then they put it up on the wall, and then we were, and on one end was our faculty in 2024 and our faculty in 2034. Like, what are we going to do 10 years apart? And we were all required to put something on this piece of paper. And so I just drew a picture of a t-shirt that said 100% funnier, and I stuck it at 2034. And I thought, like, this is like literally what I want from my career and everything else. I just want it to be funnier. And I don't mean that because I think I don't mean it because I don't think that you can be heavy or that you're not going to have all your griefs or whatever. Or that like we should be light about everything per se. I mean it because it feels really good. That's basically it. You know, like it feels good to laugh about things and just the energetic level that laughing brings, or that when you find yourself laughing, you're already at this kind of level of some kind of energetic perspective that is much freer than other forms, at least in my own experience.
No, absolutely. On the back of this question about comedy, Matt, can I get you to read the heavy poem for us?
Oh yeah, you bet. I just want to say this is a pretty heavy poem, and people who are listening to it, there's probably deserves a kind of warning about some of the content, that there is a pretty awful death that is recounted in the poem. Poem was written for my friend Will, but it's addressed to my youngest child Xylo, because Xylo and I were walking in the mountains here the day I had this call with my friend Will. So I in a way I was trying to imagine, how do I talk to my 12-year-old about all of these things? And it was also at the end of the pandemic. It's called Real Things. If violets bloom in August, the books say, that means a death is coming, or a pandemic. You can tell a violet from bladderwort by the fine ink markings in the lowest petal, a few dark marks where you split your lip open. Some things are more real than real. My friend hated himself so much he wanted to die, then he hated himself more for wanting to die, for how his children would suffer. He called me the other evening after you and I had climbed trails and decommissioned roads through light rain. And you'd put your finger right next to the tiny alpine bitterroot growing in the middle of the mountain path. After we'd walked through meadows of strawberry, chocolate lily, larkspur. After you named for me the tangled line of blue clematis, and I'd shown you the calypso orchids on the side of the ridge. Purplish and erect, all turned in one direction, their large white lips, their filaments of golden hair. He said his sister killed herself by accident, went downstairs on Christmas Day to drink herself to sleep because of something he didn't name and I didn't name, but we both knew she could only escape in the dreamless sleep of alcohol. He was scared of his sister, he told me, and for her, the intensity of her emotions, how alike they were. She didn't want to die, he said. She said that, I don't want to die. The word calypso derives from ancient Greek, to cover or hide. He found her the next afternoon, wrapped in white bed sheets. Face purple, hair golden still, a few feet from where he'd been reading to his 9-month-old daughter. I'm showing you the orchid, but I'm thinking of the violets we'd seen that day in the mountains, even though it was not August and a death had already come. blue, yellow, white. You only get to be you. Death is real. How the tiny bitter root is no bigger than the tip of your finger. How everywhere violets bloom.
Wow. Thank you so much for reading that. It was one that I had marked and that I've come back to many times. Just the way that you weave the images together here is so powerful. So I really love that poem. I wanted to ask you, not about this poem. This is a completely unrelated question, but one of the things that I do love to ask people who teach as well as write their poetry. Not that you teach your own poetry, but you teach poetry more generally, and maybe your own, who knows? How do you find your work as an instructor impacts your work as a writer?
Well, they're kind of the same thing, you know, not really different. Poetry is one of the ways that you can talk to yourself and to other people about being alive. And when I'm teaching poems is one of the ways you can talk to people about what it's like to be alive. You know, it's not the classes are kind of ostensibly about writing, but they're not really only about writing, or like they're only about writing to the degree that a poem is an expression of the path, but it's not the like how to of the path, you know. And teaching is a version of this too. You can show people forms and tricks and like procedures and practices that perhaps will increase the chances that they're looking in the right direction when the comet goes across the sky. But that's about the best you can do. And teaching, having these conversations with young people in particular, at this point in my life, it wasn't always like this. It wasn't, I've grown up, you know, I've had to grow up. And it's been a real, just an amazing gift to have that chance to grow up. So talking to people and seeing, like, listening to young people react to writing or react to artwork or react to the ideas or the things that are being shared between themselves and between like myself and them, they re constantly refresh the art. They constantly refresh everything, and I'm having to remake my own like perspective and like find a new way to say it, not just like year to year, but moment to moment in a classroom. And that's a very like feels very creative, feels ex it feels very much like being in the space of poem writing. And the their trust is another kind of like it creates a new demand on me that I can, I think I am, as I've grown up and become able to be a better teacher. And I can, as I hopefully continue to grow up, like I don't, hopefully it's not over. I'm hoping that though that's reflected in the poems, the two things are going back and forth. I really, really don't think of them as being particularly different. I think of them as being very much the same action.
Right. Very cool. Okay. Yeah. I can see how they would ask you to occupy the same space. And especially because you're teaching poetry. It's not like you're teaching something completely different, right? So,
But even that, I used to like, so I have done all kinds of things in my life before I was a teacher and also before I had this particular job. And a lot of them had to do with kind of community engaged things. like events and activism of various forms. And I never really saw any of that as being different. I always thought all of it is the same thing. And I know that that's a little perhaps esoteric way of thinking about it. And of course, there are these, like, because I'm t teaching poetry, I have developed, set pieces on when I talk about the elegy or the ode or something. And maybe those getting a chance to, like, kind of labor over how to describe that has an impact on the writing. But I think, again, sort of like the ordering of the books, sometimes we make too much of the specific, like, technical or, like, craft-based things, or, like, Robert Bringhurst says, we're not even the only people, the only creatures that write poetry. Like poetry is everything, or could be everything, any kind of making, really. So that, I don't know if I'd really answered that question, but
No, I think absolutely. Yeah. No, I think it's important to consider this as being a bigger thing than just writing a poem, but then at the same time I always feel like I'm just writing a poem, like it's a weird balance of the two things.
no, but that's
Yeah.
exactly what makes it connected. It's that you are just writing a poem.
Right.
The two thing like that's the sort of irony or something, that, like, you're just writing a poem. We're just teaching a class. We're just doing these. That's part of what makes it funny, or potentially funny. And like there's a or poems are special because on the one hand they don't do anything. This pope as Auden says, poetry makes nothing happen. And it exists or survives in a valley of its own making. This is the from the poem for Yeats. And it's that it's mere poemness that makes the poem kind of able, it makes it light enough to reach heights that we, like, in our own flesh are unable to achieve often, and in so doing, it that's that process is constantly being revised and looped down and changing. And the poem object, when it arrives, is just an expression of that process, or expression of a moment in that process.
Yeah, no, I absolutely. Okay, unfortunately, I want to talk more about that, but unfortunately, we're slowly approaching the end of our interview, Matt, and I need two things from you. One is a reading, which we'll get to in a second, but before that, I need a question from you that I can ask my next episode's guest.
What would you like your homes to be like 20 years from now?
Okay, I love this question. To be like 20 years from now. Okay. Matt, I do this mean thing where I turn the question around, so I'm going to ask you, what would you like your poems to be like 20
Well,
years from now?
I think you already know what I want them to be like. I want them to be funnier. That's I want today. Ask me next time. Who knows? Want them to be funnier.
Okay, I love it. I love that. Fantastic answer, simple answer, all we needed. Matt, could I get you to read one last poem for us before we take off?
Okay, I'm going to read you the poem that I've been reading as the last poem for everything this month. It's a poem actually from the autumn, and it's called Light Reading. It's sort of the secret poem in the very back of the book. It's not in the table of contents. It's after all of the paratext. And it's basically just me doing some reading with my plum tree, which right now looks absolutely unbelievably gorgeous. It's full of white blossoms. So it's a very happy plum tree at the moment. That's what it looks like. But this is from a few years ago in the autumn. What does a good future look like? I asked the plum tree as I steadied myself on the aluminum stepladder. In its bare branches, the tree held open a few choice pages of daylight for me to read. That's what it asks here, I said, but the plum knew that passage from memory, being a natural, as it were, in the literature of water and heat. It's wild, I said, opening and closing the pruning shears like a clapperboard. How much it takes to extract and alloy these metals, meaning the blades of the shears, the pin pinning them together, meaning the steps of the stepladder. From where I stood, I could tell the tree was ignoring me, reading ahead to where the light would gather years from now. Good answer, I thought there in the lines of the tree, where, if I stood still long enough, even I could feel the late autumn sun inscribing my body with energy.
Awesome. I love the ending of that poem. Thank you so much for reading it, Matt, and thank you so much for coming back on the show. I was so excited to get you back on here because I really enjoyed chatting with you briefly for the Best Canadian Poetry episode. You had some really cool answers, and yeah, just really excited we could make this happen. I also want to plug, by the way, that you have a reading coming up a long time from now. I don't know the date, but it's with Rob Taylor and Kevin Spence, I believe, and
Oh,
perhaps some others.
I have a
And
bunch of readings coming up.
I'm sure you do. I'm sure you do. But I want to bookmark this one because I saw the lineup and I went, I am bummed that I don't live up there,
Oh,
and I
yeah.
can't go to that reading because it would be so cool to go to that one. So anyway, if there's any readings you want to plug,
That's
though, if there's anything you
yeah,
want to
that
throw out
reading's in
there.
Kelowna on May 16th with Dallas Hunt and Kevin's
Yeah.
Rob Taylor, Colmash, and myself.
Sweet.
But I'll be in Vancouver on May 8th at the Lido for the Nightwood launch, and I'll be in Victoria on the 10th for a reading at Planet Earth, and in Courtney on the 11th, and in Nelson on the 2nd. So,
Busy. I love it.
yeah, thanks so much. I really appreciate it. And I wanted to say I really appreciate that you do this podcast and that you ask these questions and you give this venue for poetry. It's important thing to do.
Thanks. Yeah, it's a lot of fun, and I'm really looking forward to your launch on the 8th. I'm hoping I can make it out. So I'll see you there, and I hope to see if anybody's listening. I hope to see you there too. But
Thank
yeah,
you.
thanks so much, Matt. I'll throw it back to me doing a little outro, and we'll go from there. So there you go. That was me chatting with Matt Rader. Matt, thank you again for your time. I do a lot of these episodes, and recently, more so than in the past, I've been revisiting them. Not necessarily listening back to them because I don't love the sound of my own voice, but I'm one of those people. But more so just thinking back on, what a lot of poets have said on the show, and Matt's answers, both from this episode and the Best Canadian Poetry episode, have really stuck with me. I've been thinking about it in my own writing, a lot pertaining to line length and freedom of form. And we talked about starting a poem without knowing where it's going in this interview, and that's come up a lot for me over the past week as well. So lots of really strong ideas that came out of this interview that have really stuck with me personally. So personally, thank you, Matt, for taking the time to sit down and talk to me. You heard Matt talk about his readings there. He's got quite a few coming up, so do make it out to some of them if you can. I'm hoping to make it out to the one in Vancouver. And yeah, I mean, that's really the main thing. If you're interested in hearing more of this show, there's a couple things you can do. The first is follow us on Instagram at PageFrightPod. I post the new episodes there, the like announcements, so you can go and you'll find out there first. It's the first thing I do once I publish an episode. You can also follow the show. Wherever you get your podcasts, it should be a way to do that. And wherever you get your podcasts, you should be able to rate and review the show. That's super helpful because it gets more people to listen to the show and find out about the poets that I'm talking to, which is the ultimate goal of what I'm doing here. So, if you want to do any of those things, that would be fantastic. If not, I can't make you. There's no way for me to get involved. So, thank you very much for making it this far in the episode. I'm super excited to share another interview next month. I've got a few people in mind and a couple that I'm trying to line up. So, it should be great. I'm really excited to return to doing the show a bit more frequently, and I'm really excited for the interviews that are coming up. Without much else to say, my name is Andrew French. I'm on Instagram myself at Andrew W. French. And this, of course, has been H. Wright.